Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the connection between access to healthy food and the risk of obesity seems obvious at this point. We've talked so much about it, and others have. But yesterday, the New York Times science writer Gina Colata wrote about two new studies that say there is no relationship between the type of food sold in a neighborhood and obesity rates. So if obesity rates are still on the rise, but food deserts, as they're called, aren't the issue, should we rethink the conversation? Gina Colata, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having me again.
And also joining us is the executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center and adjunct instructor at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, Mark Winston Griffith. He's been active in the food justice movement in central Brooklyn and beyond. Mark, welcome back to you.
Good. Thank you, Brian.
Gina, so what are these two new studies, and how do they debunk our assumptions about food deserts, that is, urban areas where you can't buy produce, and obesity?
Well, there were three of them, but two of them are published, and one of them is about to be published and is accessible anyway because the journal doesn't have a strong embargo. But what these researchers did is they said, let's look nationally, not just, you know, because there could be these food deserts in various cities and in various neighborhoods where it's very, really hard to get fresh produce. But the question is, on a national basis, is there a link between how accessible produce is and obesity, and how accessible is produce in poor urban neighborhoods? So both of these studies did the same kind of thing. They looked at data. One study looked nationally at elementary school kids. The other one looked nationally at elementary school kids and adolescents. And the third one looked at kids in California. And they all asked, over time, the kids tended to be getting fatter. What happened to the food in their neighborhoods? Was there less produce? Do poor neighborhoods have less produce than other places? So one of the things that they found was that if you look at the stores per 1,000 people, like look in the neighborhood, like what could you walk to? What's within a mile or so of where you live? They found that actually there's more of everything in the poorer neighborhoods on a national basis, on average nationally. Not that there aren't pockets somewhere, because they didn't look at that. But on a national basis, if you're in a poor, densely populated urban neighborhood, you have everything. You have every kind of junk food you can possibly think of, and you also have produce there. So they said, and not only that, the question of whether the accessible food, produce, was linked to the children's weights, both studies found no association whatsoever.
How did they come to that conclusion? I imagine it would be a hard thing to measure.
Well, what they tried to do is they had these two different kinds of data sets. One said, what kind of business is in the area? Are they grocery stores? Are they small grocery stores? Are they supermarkets? Are they convenience stores? Are they McDonald's? What's there? And then the other thing they had was national data, which actually tracked children's weights and also what they were eating. So they said, okay, so we know how fat the kids are because they're being weighed. These are actually national government studies of kids. So we know where they live, we know who they are, we know how much they weigh, and we know what's available in their neighborhoods. So are the kids' weights linked at all to the availability of different kinds of food in their neighborhoods?
And the studies found the answer to be no.
They were not. But, you know, you could also say, you know, when I was a kid, my mother used to make my lunch for me every day and give me money to buy milk. And I used to throw away the lunch that she made. She didn't know this. And I used to take my milk money and I would buy a candy bar and an ice cream cone every day after school. So, you know, just because you have it available, kids may not be eating it.
Well, in fact, Brenda on our comments page writes, in other words, it's not a food desert, it's a food amusement park. So
right.
On
One
that,
guy called it a food swamp, like so much food.
Mark Winston Griffith, what do you make of these studies, and do you think they apply to Central Brooklyn where you work?
Well, I think that when you inject these studies into a conversation about food justice and how we eat and how we get healthy, I think it tends to sort of oversimplify the argument. That is, I work with and talk to a lot of folks who are into, are doing urban gardening and are community organizers, and we're part of a large conversation about food justice and food access. And I don't know anyone who is making the argument that, the way to healthy living and a healthier lifestyle is it's all about access to healthy food. It's so much more complex than that. And at the end of the day, we live in a complex food system. And when you talk about food retail, when you talk about consumption patterns and, what we're eating, we are at the tail end of a multi-billion-dollar food system and industry, where there are, billions of dollars of subsidies and attempts to shape the way we eat and how we eat. So, so it's not just about access to food. It's about the culture and the education. It's about marketing. It's about a whole host of things that I think go into controlling or at least affecting what it is we eat, how we eat, and what the complexion of our neighborhood is and the things we have access to. My other sort of reaction to it is, I don't know what neighborhoods they ultimately studied. I wasn't able to access the studies. But I will say that, it's not just about quantity. It's also about quality. And I don't think that, I live in Central Brooklyn, and I don't think that anyone can visit Nostrand Avenue, for instance, and then compare that to Fifth Avenue in Park Slope or Seventh Avenue in Park Slope or Smith Avenue and say that, what is available there is the same. And not only in terms of quantity, there's just far more options as far as available food, but also just, in terms of full-service restaurants as well.
So, Gina, to quote John Weidman from your article, not all grocery stores are created equal. And I wonder what you think about that dynamic that Mark just brought up, and if there's science to back up that thought, or maybe it has to do with the price of fresh produce versus what's easily available on the McDonald's dollar menu.
I'm just a messenger here. I'm the reporter, but I it's very hard to disagree with what Mark said. I mean, I think almost everybody I spoke to would say there's a whole lot more involved than just saying let's plop a grocery store into a neighborhood. On the other hand, you can have all sorts of little. It's very hard to generalize from the examples you see around you. I actually chose a neighborhood in Camden, New Jersey. I asked one of the researchers, because of privacy things, she couldn't give me I said, tell me exactly where these places were so I can go there. And then she said, well, she could give me some lists of areas. So I chose a place in Camden, and I went to this poor neighborhood, and I asked some of the parents standing around the school about, are there any grocery stores around here? And they said, oh, yeah, just walk down the street and turn left. And I was stunned. First of all, there's so much junk food available, I couldn't believe it. But I also saw some really nice produce at a Pathmark, a huge produce supply, that was it was cheaper than what I can get where I live. And where I live in Princeton, and I decide I'm kind of in a food desert because I have to drive 15 minutes to get to a grocery store. And the produce is really expensive. If I walk through town, what I see is expensive ice cream, expensive candy stores. I see some pizza places. And I see a few places where they have, small supplies of very expensive produce. So it's sort of funny. You could say, oh, well, here I am in a place where people are thin and it's a food desert. And there I went to Camden, and I don't know whether people were thin or fat because all you have is, you see someone on the street. What do you know about the average weight there? But on the other hand, weirdly enough, they had a produce stand, they had a Pathmark, they had a Save-A-Lot, and they had a vacant lot with a sign saying Farmer's Market coming soon. But they also had so much food that you would not want your kids to eat, that you would not believe it.
The food amusement park, the food swamp.
But it was just chance. You know, I could have gone to another neighborhood and seen nothing. It was just, you know, just random chance.
Janet in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Janet.
I think the gentleman just pretty much said what I called in about. You might have some vegetables in the local supermarket, like a Pioneer or Key Food, but the quality of it is horrible. It's not shiny. It looks like it's already going bad. So it looks like they purchased, like, third-rate vegetables, and it's horrible. Like, who wants to buy that? I even look at it myself trying to be healthy, and I don't even want to buy it.
Thank you for your call. Scott in Sussex County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Good. What's up?
Well, I just kind of wanted to bring up one point. I actually used to work at a farmer's market in Newark, New Jersey. It was a program that the city was trying to start to try to introduce more vegetables to the city, and they actually had an even more substantial plan to actually grow vegetables on a barge that floats out in the water. But everything kind of fell apart because the city of Newark actually gave us money so that we would be able to get there and start the market and get some business, and then hopefully that it would start up on its own enough that we'd make money.
So
however,
that story, even so far, would indicate that there was a shortage of produce, at least in the area of Newark that you're referring to.
Absolutely. And one thing they're actually doing is trying to – there's currently a brick city garden. They grow vegetables on a vacant city block, and there's techniques like that. But there was certainly a shortage. But what we found is that we really only sold certain items, and those items were certainly not enough to make money, and we actually had to cancel the whole market.
So do you think there's a demand problem that, you know, like if bodegas knew they could sell out really good produce, they would probably stock it more, Scott?
I think they certainly would. And I also think that, there's certainly a big issue of, you know, our produce is right across the street from a Burger King, and certainly everybody was going into the Burger King because it was cheaper. They can't really just take, you know, a head of lettuce and chop it up right there and make a salad. So it's a convenience and a price thing, I really think. Thanks for my call.
Thank you very much for your call. So, Mark Winston Griffith, that's really interesting. I mean, the Department of Agriculture says Central Brooklyn is not considered a food desert. So should we stop talking about food deserts on the supply side and start talking about demand?
I think we need to talk about all of it. The folks who I work with don't really use the term food desert very much. It's not a term we embrace. And I think, you know, when you do talk about the United States, it's sort of an absurd term, right? I mean, as we were just saying before, that I think the problem is not that we don't have any food, is that there's so much of it, and the bad stuff is what is being pushed at us. So, yeah, when we talk about a place like Central Brooklyn, you have to not only use more precise language, but a more precise analysis of what is actually happening. And, you know, we've mentioned some of those things already. And I think price, you know, which I didn't bring up before, but which others have, I think is an important part of it. When you look at a place like Central Brooklyn, which is undergoing gentrification, and you talk about, you know, healthy food options, when you look at, and you look at those grocery stores that are providing that, they are oftentimes seen as sort of harbingers of gentrification, and are not often priced for the people who have been here for generations. So, you know, I think that whatever approach we use, we're going to have to make sure that the healthy food is not only accessible, but it's also affordable and is weaved into the lifestyle, into the thinking, into the culture of the people who live here.
Well, provocative article in the New York Times yesterday by Gina Colada, citing studies about the availability of food in low-income urban areas being more than many people assumed. Gina, thank you. Mark Winston Griffith from the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism and director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, our series with Gridlock Sam Schwartz continues today. His proposal for trucks and other commercial vehicles on the roads of New York City, including Let 'em on the Belt Parkway. Stay with us.